From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Here's one way to look at Utah's water predicament for the future. Compare it to your bank account. That's how one Utah water manager explains it in a new documentary airing on KUED this week. Mother Nature only gives you so much. And because of growth, because of waste, because of outdated infrastructure and thinking, we are overdrafting, overusing water and the water underneath the surface. It's hard to say just how much, but KUER's Judy Faye says the drought of groundwater in Utah is worse, much worse, than California. That's just one of the issues we're talking about today as we look at Utah's water future. Can Utahns, water managers, politicians, residents themselves, find a new strategy, a new paradigm for a new reality? Join us after the news.
Hi, this is Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. Our online audio and podcasts are made possible by KUER and its listeners. If you like Radio West, help us make it happen. Become a sustaining member of KUER for as little as $5 a month. You can do that online at KUER.org. And thanks.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. A new documentary airing this week on public television KUED points out that water has always shaped the West, the landscape, the culture, the nature of the way we've grown. So we've built dams and irrigation ditches and pipelines, and as the documentary points out, we've come to expect water on demand and always. But the film, which was reported by KUER's environment reporter Judy Faze, also points out Utah and other Western states find themselves in a challenging new era for water, one that could endanger plans for the future. So today in the program, we're talking about Utah's water future. The film is going to be airing on KUED on Wednesday. It's called Utah's Uncertain Water Future. And today in the program, as I said, we're talking about it, some of the questions that it raises. How do we manage a finite resource in a world of growing needs? What's the best use of water? Is it for drinking, for food, for power, for development, all of those things? And how do you find a balance in all of that? 801-585-WEST is the number to join the conversation. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Judy Faze is joining us throughout the program. She reported and wrote the documentary which we're talking about. It's a joint project of KUER News and KUED Channel 7. Give you the details about that as we go along. We'll be hearing from our news director, Terry Gilday, a little bit later in the program. He has some related stories that are going to be airing on KUER throughout the week. Judy Faze, welcome back.
Hey, Doug.
So I guess I wanted to get your thinking on this issue as you began, as you jumped in. Like, what were the things that you were thinking you wanted to cover and, like, the big issues that you thought this was about? I mean, we'll talk about what you learned along the way, but how did you start?
That's a great question. I think you can't tumble into this subject without a certain naivete. I thought water seems like an interesting issue, especially in the context of climate change and and Utah's situation in the middle of these different climate regimes, projected climate regimes. So it seemed like that would be interesting. But at the same time, there are also just a almost seemingly infinite number of inquiries that are going on about water right now and have been for the last few years. So while for me it was a discovery that this is a big issue of our time, we've had legislative panels and task forces and reports. They've been rolling out over at least the last decade. So it gave me a chance to kind of catch up and learn a little bit more about what was going on and to help bring that information to the public, help people see that this is something that we're going to have to start reckoning with.
This is such a simple-minded question, and I promise we'll dig into it. Was it worse than you thought?
I think I would say it's more nuanced than I thought. In some respects, I think I was surprised at how many problems that we have that we might not really grasp that we have. One really good example is Walt Baker, who is the director of water quality in Utah, And Mike Styler, who's the director of the Department of Natural Resources, gave a presentation at the legislature last fall. And it was really interesting. They talked about the Jordan Valley and Utah Lake drainage and how there are, I want to say, 140 or 160,000 water rights files statewide, 32,000 in that, in just that little area. And they said it would take either 100 years at current staffing levels or $140 million in maybe a decade to sort out just the 32,000 water rights in that basin.
Wow.
You know, and one thing that, that protects, I think, the Utah Valley and Salt Lake Valley is the Wasatch Mountains. We get our water not just from the ground, but also from the rivers and streams. And so that seems to insulate us somewhat. But if you look at that as a microcosm, the Utah Valley, Jordan Valley, River Valley situation, that is staggering to me. And it's, again, something that, that people in water circles have been talking about. Maybe just we haven't been talking about them.
Yeah. Well, one thing that always comes up, and you deal with this early on in the film, is this question of Utah's sort of historic role and relationship with water. And I wanted to ask you something about that. How unique was Utah? I mean, the Mormon pioneers coming here, I mean, they were seen as kind of brilliant in the way they captured water, the way they thought about it and managed it. I mean, does that make Utah kind of unique, at least in that part of the story, for water in the West?
I think maybe the way Utah is unique in that story is the faith element of it, that it wasn't simply just, oh, we want to establish a city here where people who think that this is a great place to grow. People were sent there literally on missions, and they were carrying out God's will, basically. And that, I think, fueled their determination, their ingenuity, and maybe in some respects a kind of a blindness about the limits of the resource.
Why would you go and develop, at least in the 19th century, in the southern part of the state? Well, they went because God and Brigham Young told them to go, and so they had to figure it out?
Basically, yeah. I think that's a beautiful part of the story, and I think it really informs our future. We talked to, in the documentary, a historian in southern Utah named Lyman Hafen, and he had such a beautiful feel for the subject. And, you know, he pointed out that people really believed in the value of this place and their role in establishing the community there and sharing their beliefs. And you had to have water to do it, but they had really crummy water supplies, so they had to be ingenious. He read from his book, and I can find that passage for you if you're interested, where he talks about, you know, our community is growing, we have more people, more businesses, and it's 1909. You know, it's exactly where we are in 2015, but only over 100 years ago.
Yeah. Let's hear from Lyman Hafen, actually, from the documentary Utah's Uncertain Water Future.
I think we still see it as this is a place where we were destined to come and to live and to raise our families and to worship according to the dictates of our conscience. We saw it as a challenge to figure out how to make a life here in a very desolate place. That feeling has carried through in this culture all through the decades.
What do you mean when you say in the film that duty and destiny still seems to drive Utah water managers?
Well,
it's that same sense.
Yes, I believe so. There weren't many conversations that we had where we didn't hear the idea from water managers that the job of water managers is not to decide whether we should limit growth or maybe this isn't such a good project, or it's to build,
make it happen.
Is to make it happen.
Yeah.
It's to build for when they come. And they really believed that those people were coming, and they still, I think we still do to a certain extent. One of the resources that I relied on during developing the story was author Cynthia Barnett has a book called Blue Revolution. She actually had spoken at the U about a year or so ago. And one of the concepts that she talks about quite a bit is our illusion of abundance. And we just think that water, there is no end to water. It comes from the sky. It comes from the ground. It comes from the mountains. And it's in the sea. So we just don't think that water is limited. But the pie is limited. Yeah. The water pie is a finite resource, and that's not going to change. It actually might shrink a little bit. I think that's something that's under quite a bit of debate. But even if the pie is limited, we still have twice as many, or three, or five, or 10, or 20 times as many people as we did, 100 years ago. And so,
and that number is going to double in some 45 years.
Yeah. So how do we deal with that? I think that changes the whole equation quite a bit.
Who's using the water? I mean, that's a big one, and this is one that I think we need to sort of underscore. 80% agriculture.
More than 80%. 83 or 85%. Yes. And that's the water that we actually develop and cultivate. There's actually a big portion of water that goes to the environment. We don't catch it because it's out there, watering the trees in the desert and that kind of thing. But we a lot of the water that we catch, that we extract from the ground, goes to agriculture. And it's interesting because it's I'm trying to think of the right way to put this. It's radioactive, basically. Hmm. That subject of how do we deal with water that agriculture is using. I know that the state has a conservation program. We want to reduce 20-25% by 2025. And we're well on our way towards that goal. Washington County, where the Lake Powell pipeline would go, has already exceeded that goal. But if you take a small percentage of the pie, like maybe 10% is domestic use, and we reduce our use by 30%. That's great. That's a couple percent.
So Xeriscape and stop watering your lawn, and there's all kinds of campaigns and talk about that. But that doesn't take into account the 80%.
It doesn't. And that has to be part of the discussion. I think it is part of the discussion. We talk a little bit about that in the film.
Right.
But
which we'll get to. I think that's actually really interesting. But is this a taboo?
It kind of is. It's a big taboo to really talk about it. And Pat Mulroy, who's also interviewed in the documentary, talks about how that is such a hot button issue. But it's one that really has to be part of the discussion, because we need to find a way to account for that agricultural water. Some of the water over time has shifted. Agricultural use water has shifted to cities and towns. But that's been a very gradual process, and there's probably going to be more. I don't think I met anyone who said that there wouldn't be more agricultural water that was used in communities.
See, it's so interesting because Utah is, if not the most, one of the most urban states in the country. Along the Wasatch Front, more people tend to live in these urban areas, and yet we're so tied to this idea of agriculture. That must make it difficult to broach that subject, to deal with that issue of limiting the water in agriculture. Is that right?
Well, and maybe this goes back to what we were talking about earlier about the faith component of this, because it's about our identity. It's not just about math and, if we just divide the pie differently and these people get a certain percentage and those people get a different percentage. It's really about what we believe about who we are, and this idea that, that agricultural water is being used for food. Oddly enough, Pat Mulroy doesn't say, no, we need to take all the money, all the water from agriculture. She says we need to work with that better, because we need food, and that's how we get our food, is with that water.
Let's talk a little bit about the Lake Powell pipeline. This is one of these segments which I think it illustrates a lot and underscores all of this. This is unique. You point out that state planners believe, I mean, we talked about the fact that, Utah is going to double, but the Southwest could quadruple by 2060?
Yeah, I think the number is about 150,000 now, and they're saying about 600,000. Those numbers are disputed. People who are advocates for the pipeline say they're way too low, that it'll probably be five times as many. People who are critics of the pipeline say, oh, it's never going to get that big, that water ought to be a limiting factor in terms of growth. But regardless, this is a solution or an issue that has to be dealt with in advance. You can't sort of wait until, you know, you're totally out of water before you start to figuring out how are you going to get some.
The pipeline, this so-called Lake Powell pipeline. Give us a sense of the scale of something like this and the cost of something like this, because lawmakers are all in. I mean, they've committed the state. This was in, I think you say in the documentary, back in 2006. They committed the state to fund this thing, at least initially, get the county to reimburse them over 100 years or 90 years or something like that. But give us a sense of the scale of a project like this.
I think that was one of the things that I found really interesting. Okay, Lake Powell Pipeline, you know, you just put a little straw in there. But this is a huge straw. It's basically 139 miles. It's almost 6 feet in diameter. It's, I think, 59 inches, something like that. And
wow.
And the amount of water that they say they're going to provide is amazing. It's, again, just this confidence in engineering to solve our problems. It's been a concept for well over a decade.
Is it seeming more realistic or less so?
Well, there's a discussion about the water in Lake Powell and whether that's going to be enough to serve the population in the future. And we don't get deeply into that discussion.
Right.
It's a pretty big discussion. It's something that's already being hashed out with the upper basin states of Wyoming, Utah, Colorado, and then the lower basin states, Arizona, California, Nevada, have their own look at it. And so they're trying to balance the water needs between Lake Powell and Lake Mead. And, you know, Las Vegas, they rely on Lake Mead for 90% of their water. And it just this past weekend or just recently reached a historic low where it triggers this whole emergency situation about balancing. So it's a big deal. The question of whether there's enough water. There's some people who say we should, you know, get rid of Lake Powell altogether and put all that water in Lake Mead and call it good. Use the water a little differently. Obviously, I think the upper basin states would be very resistant to that idea.
They might be. Well, one of the things that comes up, I want to have you talk a little bit about Ron Thompson, because he seems to express something that you hear a lot of, and that is, this is our water. We are entitled to this water, and we need to get as much of it as we can. Of course, we should point out right now this water is shared by other states, Arizona and Nevada and, of course, California. That's crucial right now, given what's going on in California. And what would happen to them if we captured more of it? I want to play this clip from the film. This is Ron Thompson, because he does seem. I want you to maybe set this up for us, because he does seem to express this sentiment that this is ours.
And again, I think that's a really fascinating dimension of it. That's not about numbers and engineering. It's about people and this idea that this is our birthright. This is, you know, our last really big share of the Colorado River system. And we haven't developed it. We've let it go downstream over the years. I can't really remember any hearings or meetings, water meetings that I've been in the last few years where I haven't heard that come up, that we need to cultivate this water because it's our share. And that's one of the bases of Western water laws, use it or lose it. So we're sitting there saying, well, we got to use this or we're going to lose it. And so a lot of the other priorities that other people might have may not really come to the surface as well because of that. And in fact, one of the things that came up was we were talking about you know, well, what about Las Vegas buying that water, for instance? They could really use it. And the idea was, oh, no way. You know, that's our water. We're not. It's a moral and personal and deep thing that doesn't have to do with money or anything like that. It has to do with Utah and who we are.
The question really is, does Utah, who has a big water right that comes into Lake Powell every year, can only get it out of Lake Powell, do they allow that water to stay here so it sustains our economy and we use our water here, or do we allow it to go downstream to support and sustain other economies and other citizens that aren't that doesn't help our kids or our economy?
That's interesting. This is our economy. Why should we be helping theirs? Let them figure it out. I mean, it's not to say that Ron Thompson's being crass or he's being selfish, but, you know, I mean, he represents a constituency, and that's his point.
But it's also the way we are. It's the way this whole system has been set up. That's one of the foundational concepts of Western water law. You know, use it or lose it. This is ours. Let's make the most of it. And again, I think in a way, some of the most radical ideas in this whole documentary are more about the idea of sharing, that this is that instead of looking at state boundaries, we need to look at basin boundaries, for instance, and all of the population within those boundaries. And I guess that's probably a convenient thing for maybe Nevada and Arizona and Colorado or California to say, but that's kind of radical in the environment that this is coming from.
We'll come back to that because I think that's really important. There's a conservationist in the film named Jane Whalen. She works with an organization in St. George called Citizens for Dixie's Future. I want to play a clip from her because she talks about this idea that we need to start thinking differently about all of this. Here's Jane Whalen from the documentary Utah's Uncertain Water Future.
They plunked this community in the middle of the desert. So we have to learn how to live in the desert and use water in the best way and value it in a different way. So there needs to be a whole new paradigm.
What does she mean by that? How can you think differently about it? Haven't we figured all the ways to think about this? I mean, what does she have in mind?
Well, I think that, and I think Lyman Hafen will talk about this too. I'm not sure that actually made the documentary, but he says, you know, a lot of the pioneers who settled southwestern Utah came from places like Wisconsin and Illinois, and they brought their idea of trees and big gardens with them. And so that's a value system that might not. Well, it doesn't work in a desert. It's a different landscape, and water is not abundant. It's very limited. So, you know, we talk a little bit about how the Paiute Indians looked at water and used water, and were able to live in that area for centuries. But their demands on it weren't the kind that ours are now, with our trees and our fountains and our golf courses and that kind of thing.
So it was a culture that was based on the realities of their landscape, as opposed to one that was trying to transplant something from somewhere else.
Right. And I don't know that I'm convinced that if the environmental groups put together this great alternative called the Local Waters Alternative. And they talk about having the same amount of growth that's being projected by the governor's office, for instance, but using a lot more reused water, more conservation.
Water pricing,
smarter water pricing, and that helping to solve the problem without trying to dig up more water somehow. So it's possible. Another thing that Lyman Hafen brings up, which is really important, is that back in the turn of the century, you could be jailed and fined for wasting water. They knew the value of water in a desert. So if you were, if you wasted water and you were convicted, you could be thrown in jail for 25 days, you know, which I think would be devastating to a family at that time. You could face a $25 fine. So, yes, it was priced high, too.
You don't get into this in the film, but this does raise the question, when did we switch? When did water start to become cheap?
My guess is that technology has a big role in it. And when we were able to start, we didn't hand dig our wells, but we were able to use electricity to pump the water out from...
It took less effort to get it to your tap.
Exactly. Yeah. When we were able to engineer pipeline systems that could get the water to your door without any trouble. I think those were factors in helping us forget that you know, we're not hauling it from the river. We're turning on the tap. That's the amount of exertion that we go through to get it.
Judy Fais is with us, KUER's environmental reporter. She reported and wrote a new documentary called Utah's Uncertain Water Future. It's a joint project of KUER News and KUED Channel 7. There's a free screening tomorrow evening at the Utah Museum of Contemporary Art. You can see it on television when it premieres on Wednesday evening at 7 o'clock. We have all of the details about that on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we are talking about Utah's water picture in the future. Water, always an issue in the West, of course, but with climate change, with historic drought conditions, with a population continuing to grow, state officials, really officials around the region, are going to have to come up with some kind of strategy for water use in the future. KUER's Judy Fais has been reporting on this issue, well, for a long time. She's produced a documentary that's a joint project of KUER News and KUED Channel 7. It's airing on KUED on Wednesday. We'll give you the details about that. It's called Utah's Uncertain Water Future, and she's joining us to talk about it. You see in the film this, that the traditions that Utah water managers say have served the state so well are beginning to come apart. And then you explore this fascinating issue that I can't say I really knew anything about. This issue called subsidence, fissures that are developing in the Utah landscape. Talk about this part of the story.
Well, it's something that's been out there. Actually, Utah's been experiencing subsidence and fissures for, I want to say, since the 70s. And most of that's happening in the farmland.
Yeah.
And so what it is that the water is being extracted to the extent that the ground surface is collapsing and basically cracks form on the sides of these subsided basins that are created. Now, in Utah, it's not a wide scale problem. I don't know if I can even really say that because I don't really know.
Yeah.
And I don't know that we have the tools, we've used the tools so far to find out how extensive it is around the state. But in California and Nevada and Arizona, there are just these horror stories. When we went out and talked to Pat Mulroy, she brought us to the place where Las Vegas has its first wells. And those were Mormon settlers who actually cultivated that area. And you can see the place where the surface of the earth used to be is at about head height. Now, so it's sunk.
Wow.
So much because of all the water that's been extracted. I think Bill Lund in our story told us at one point that in parts of California it was, I want to say, 30 feet or more.
Because aquifers are being
overdrawn. Yeah.
Land just naturally fills in that gap.
Right. And in fact, in central Utah, you know, the water table's falling in a foot or two a year because we've essentially over-appropriated the water.
And we don't give it enough time to recharge.
Yes, it takes 20, 30, 40 years. It takes decades to recharge the aquifer, but we're taking out so much water. And apparently the increase in that extraction has... you know, coincided with the development that we've had since the war, and again, the availability of pumps and electricity to make that work.
Let me play a clip. This is Bill Lund. He's an expert on geological hazards for the Utah Geological Survey. You use him in the film because you report that these fissures are turning up at farms around the state. Milford, Escalante, the southern part of the Cedar Valley. There's even a surprising place that you'll mention in the film.
Yeah,
we'll leave that
yeah.
to you. to you to reveal on Wednesday. But here's Bill Lund.
Ground subsidence and earth fissures have come to Utah. There is no doubt about it. The water table in the valley now is dropping about 2 feet a year. If it continues to drop at 2 feet a year and nothing is done about it, then we're going to start looking like Nevada and California and Arizona before long. So, you know, the lessons from our surrounding states are that this can be a serious problem. Are we there? No, we're not anywhere near that problem. But the signs are here. The canary in the coal mine is here. And our opportunities are now to start dealing with these problems to make sure that we don't repeat the lessons, the hard lessons, from some of our surrounding states.
So our state leaders, our water managers, are they seeing the signs? Are they acknowledging this as a canary?
They are, but don't you think it's kind of interesting that the big crisis of subsidence and fissures really happened in 2005 with the flooding that we have? And basically what happened was we had floodwaters going over the Escalante Valley, and then there were fissures, and you'd see these, you know, basically cascades going down in the farmers' fields. There's some really amazing images of that. But boy, I hadn't heard of it until years and years after that. And now, to me, it seems as though those are very vivid examples of we need to get our house in order. We need to sort of really get a grasp of what the situation is and how to deal with it. In 2008, I think it was, either 2006 or 2008, I'm sorry, I can't remember the date exactly, the legislature passed a bill that allowed the state engineer to force water conservation in areas where they were having this overdrafting. And so farmers in the Escalante Valley were basically given, well, they developed a plan to limit the extraction over 90 years. And so we talked to one of the farmers who's done so much in that area just by rotating the kinds of crops he's growing.
This is Bob Holt?
Yeah, it is. Just by rotating the crops that he has and growing corn instead of alfalfa, he saved enough water to essentially cover that first cut. And so, yes, there are problems, and I think it's clear that the leaders recognize there are problems. Otherwise, they wouldn't have required this plan. And there are other plans like this that are going on throughout the state. So they're just beginning to apply this principle in other areas. But to me, it's such an example of, boy, you know, there are solutions. But we just really haven't even asked the questions. We haven't acknowledged the problem to the extent that we've said, oh, we can fix this. This is how we can do it.
Well, Bob Holt's a good example because he's there on that land. He wants his family to stay on that land and to farm. I'm guessing he's a fairly conservative kind of guy, yet he's doing something that would be perceived as kind of progressive, shifting, adapting. That must give you some sense of optimism that people can make some changes to deal with all of this, I guess.
Yes, very much so. And I think it's pretty exciting, again, just the fact that we've been able to start asking the question and posing that we have a problem that needs solving. We've had people come up with some really good answers. In the Cedar Valley, the Iron County Water Conservancy District is talking about using the water that they have from Coal Creek and creating a desedimentation basin so that they can basically stoke the groundwater supply. They can fast track the water because it was so murky that it wasn't actually making it into the groundwater. It was kind of clogging up, I guess, is the way to put it. So they have that plan that they're working on. You know, the pipelines are still out there, the dams are still out there, and I think that it's a really good discussion to have. But I do see these other solutions that are coming forward as well.
Let's talk a little bit more about Pat Mulroy. You mentioned her before, and I think a lot of people who kind of know these issues know her. She's kind of an iconic figure in the story of water in the West. She can be seen as a villain and seen as a hero, sometimes by the same people. She fought tenaciously for the water rights of Nevada. But she's also been seen as a kind of a progressive figure for her use of conservation and those kinds of things. You talk to her. What were you trying to get from her, just broadly? Because she has a lot to say about this issue, obviously.
Well, a couple things. Pat's no longer with the Southern Nevada Water Authority. She's now with the Brookings Institution's Mountain West program. And she's also on the Water Council for the World Economic Forum. And so she her perspective has gone even bigger. And so I was thinking that she seems to be at the center of so many of these questions. She's sort of lived through, you know, how do you have people, you know, pull up their lawns? How do you increase prices for water? How do you get the business community to buy into this idea that they can buy their way out of it, buy their way out of the problem? And so she just had so many really interesting ideas. And while I think we all look at the fountains in Las Vegas and say, oh, that's so wasteful, and all the golf courses, you know, the way they've replumbed the city to make that possible is pretty impressive. And again, they get such a small fraction of the water from Lake Powell, and yet they're able to support that city on it. It's really, I think she has a lot to say, a lot to tell us.
She's great in the film, and I want to play a clip from her. One of the things she talks about is there needs to be a mosaic. That the solution isn't just, and I think maybe that's the thinking that's been going on. And maybe that's a reflection of just the way we all politically think in the United States right now. It's either this one or this one. But Mulroy's pretty progressive in her sense that it's not just one thing. We've got to figure these out. And she calls it a mosaic.
Yeah. I think that is a really powerful idea. And in fact, we sort of superimpose that with a conversation with a Shivwitz council member, a Paiute Shivwitz band member, talking about the Shivwitz have always believed that everything in the environment talks to one another, the animals, the landscape, the flowers, the water,
yeah.
and that there has to be a dialogue in order to coexist.
Can I play that clip?
Sure, I would love that.
Yeah, this is Glenn Rogers. He's a council member of the Shivwitz band of the Paiute. He's talking about this. He calls it a conversation with water from the film Utah's Uncertain Water Future.
The water is a giver of life and a taker of life, and we have to respect the water in that sense, because the Creator put the water on this earth and everything on this earth. And so through that Creator, we talk to them and talk through the water to help us sustain life and to help us live and to, I guess, in the Anglo way, you call it to bless your soul, because without water, you're not going to live.
It's interesting that the taking lessons from the native peoples who have always had to deal with that reality of water, I guess.
And that was exactly the reason I really wanted to include that perspective, because we're so full of ourselves. We think we have all the answers when really the answers have been around for a long time. So I thought it was fascinating that someone who basically represents a culture that's been around for thousands of years is talking, saying kind of the same thing as someone like Pat Mulroy, who sort of represents, you know, the modern water use and modern water development. So
Pat Mulroy represents this idea of sharing, mm-hmm. which we come back to. I want to play another clip from her and so we can get a sense of what she has to say, because Mulroy says climate change is like she's saying it's the test.
It's the game changer is what she calls it.
Right. And what she seems to worry about the most, and we'll hear in this clip, is that the middle ground may suffer.
Getting each of the states to perceive of themselves as part of a larger region is another big challenge. This is where politics becomes unfortunate. My only advice to Utah is they need to become more actively engaged in helping resolve issues as they're arising in the basin and not view themselves as separatists. No one in the Colorado River system is an island, and there are real strengths in strategic partnerships. Being able to pull together during the worst of times will help everybody get through. But if you view yourself as an island and you pull off, don't be surprised if when you need help, there's no one behind you to help you.
It's Pat Mulroy from the documentary Utah's Uncertain Water Future, the question of whether the states can cooperate. We'll get to that when we get back from a break. Judy Faze is with us. She is KUER's environmental reporter. She reported and wrote the documentary, a joint project of KUER News and KUED Channel 7. There's a free screening tomorrow evening at the Utah Museum of Contemporary Arts. You can see it on television, of course, when it premieres on KUED. That's Wednesday evening at 7. We have all the details on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. We'll take a break and be back in just a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we are talking about Utah's water picture in the future. A documentary, which is airing on KUED Channel 7 this week, deals with that question. It's reported by KUER's Judy Faze. It's a joint project, actually, of KUER News and KUED Channel 7. We'll give you the details about that a little bit later. We have Judy with us. Terry Gilday is now joining us, KUER's news director. He edited, narrated the documentary. And Terry, welcome back. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Doug.
So I started kind of broadly with Judy at the beginning, what she was interested in. Give me your sense of what interests you about this and what you were going for in the project.
Sure. There's so much information that you can glean from water in Utah. There's the policy story of the Lake Powell pipeline. There's the science of the subsidence and the groundwater extraction.
But, do you know anything about subsidence before all this?
I'd heard about what was happening in California and Nevada, but I had no idea it was happening in Utah, and it's been happening for quite a while. I think that was a big find.
Huge.
For Judy.
It's a really interesting part of the story.
And Bill Lund and his crew down in Iron County, they're really fascinating individuals, and how the folks in Iron County are dealing with it, because groundwater has become a source that people have to turn to as surface water sources dry up. And so, and we've seen the devastation that's happening in California and Nevada. So it's a huge warning sign. But, overall with the series, I think what I wanted to accomplish is to raise people's awareness about water. I think that a lot of what we talk about in the documentary, in the film, and also in the radio pieces that we're running this week can be very polarizing. There's a lot of people who are involved and have a lot of stakeholders in these issues that are firmly on one side or the other. But for the average person like me who wakes up in the morning, turns my tap on, there's water there. I can use the toilet in my house. I can water my lawn. Why should I be thinking about water? Why should I be engaged in that situation? And so what I wanted to accomplish is to do a series of stories both on television and on radio that get people thinking about how they contribute to this whole process. Can they change their behavior? Does changing their behavior help the situation in one way, shape, or form? It's easy when you've got water coming out of your tap to not think about how that affects you or others or everybody else around you, but it does. It really does.
But we've been talking about this for 30 years. Do you think we're at a point? I mean, is there some? I mean, one of the things that Judy mentions in the piece is that we're sort of at this crossroads. Is it climate change sort of making it now we can no longer really look away? That we in fact are at the point when we are going to have to do something. Actually, we can't just—it's not academic anymore.
I think we have to. I think the statistics are there. We had one of the driest years on record so far in 2015. We've had over the last 6 to 8 years some of the warmest years on record. There's really not a point to hesitate about this. I know that there are a lot of politicians and policymakers who want us to believe otherwise. But as a citizen, as a human being, the evidence for me is overwhelming.
I think one thing I'd like to add on that, too, though, is that we talk a little bit about the groundwater drought. And, we look at California and there's this big red bullseye on the drought monitor about California not running out of water. But Utah has a drought in its groundwater.
Which is worse, you say.
Well, because it takes decades to solve, not a season or two. It'll take decades to reverse that. And so we're way more like Nevada than we are like California right now, and that's not a good thing.
It is interesting that this doesn't, I mean, surely there are political dimensions to this, but the documentary is not terribly political. It's not terribly ideological.
Well, and I think that that's for very good reason. I think the politicians and the environmental groups have been great at keeping these issues, bubbling and interesting. to the public. However, this is a problem for all of us. It's not about, you know, red states, blue states. It's not about farmers or, you know, people with kids. It's about everyone. And so I think that I hope that we depoliticized it to a great extent so that people can grasp their own stake in this fight.
Terry, you're also producing stories in connection with all of this. I wanted to ask you about a couple of these. 10% of Utah's water is lost to leaks.
So one of the stories that I'm doing, which will air on Thursday morning, is about Salt Lake City's infrastructure. And, you know, we've been a city since pioneers settled here more than 150 years ago. And the water infrastructure, the pipes, how water is moved through the city has changed dramatically through that time. I spent a day hanging out with Jeff Niermeyer, who is the head of Salt Lake City Public Utilities, and his office is this kind of wonderful museum. He has all of these really cool sort of pieces of pipe all around, and he was showing me some pipes from pioneer days that are actually made out of wood. They're logs that were hollowed out when the pioneers were first pulling water off of the City Creek watershed into the city, and you know, wood would warp when it got wet, so they had to figure out how they could do that, and they actually how they could make it work. Jeff showed me this amazing pipe that's over a century old, and it had a layer of coal tar inside of it to keep the pipe from expanding. Now, imagine what the water would have tasted like coming out of that pipe. It was pretty crazy. But you know, Jeff and the city of Salt Lake have an amazingly sophisticated system that tracks how old pipes are, when they're leaking, when they need to be repaired. And it's a cyclical thing. There's always going to be a situation where pipes are being updated, where pipes are being repaired. And losing about 8 to 10% is about average for U.S. cities. You know, Jeff and the folks at Public Utilities want that to be less, and they're going to keep working on that. But the good news is that Salt Lake City is, when it comes to leaks, they're not a reactive city. They don't wait for a pipe to burst. I mean, you know, we have situations where that happened. We had a water main burst on Foothill Drive not too long ago. I think a lot of people remember that being stuck in traffic for hours. But Salt Lake City is proactive. They actually employ an individual who goes out every day in a van and searches for leaks, uses very sophisticated audio equipment. And I got to hang out with him, and he'll be a part of the story as well. So the good news is we're proactive, and the city has a really really good and sophisticated system in place to detect leaks and stay on top of them as much as they can.
There's another story you're producing I want you to talk a little bit about, which is, you know, sort of, it's basically how water is treated, how it's processed. And you compare what is being done here in Utah against what's happening in Wichita Falls, Texas.
Yeah, so Salt Lake City, we're incredibly lucky. We're incredibly fortunate that we have four or five watersheds that come out of the Wasatch Front and deliver relatively pristine drinking water just from the streams. They're treated with different water treatment plants. I spent some time at the Big Cottonwood Canyon water treatment plant, but the water is filtered. It's treated with a little bit of chlorine, some ferric, some lime. It's got fluoride put in it, which is part of that process, and then it goes to our taps. We don't have to extract groundwater sources. We don't have to do any of that stuff. Wichita Falls is a community in North Texas. It's in kind of near the panhandle of Texas, and their surface water sources have been shrinking for more than a decade. They depend on two separate lakes outside of Wichita Falls that had been shrinking to 50% capacity and to about 25% capacity about 5 years ago. And they're like, we have to do something. Yeah. And so they're doing what a lot of cities are looking into now, which is recycling human wastewater and making it into potable water. And there's a lot of great science and technology to do that. And
are they doing it?
They are doing it. They've been doing it for more than a year.
They get past the kind of ick factor, which is always part of this?
They did. I talked to Mark Southard, who's the water purification manager for Wichita Falls, and he says he gets reports of people saying the water tastes better now, being 50% recycled human wastewater along with lake water. Yeah. But it is getting past that ooh factor. But, you know, in Salt Lake City, I talked with Laura Briefer as well, who's the water resources manager. We're not at that point yet.
No.
But they're looking into potentially that for secondary water, for agricultural use and other industrial uses. I mean, why does it have to be – why can't we recycle that wastewater, other water, with reverse osmosis and all these very sophisticated technologies which make the water quite clean and use it for other other problems and projects?
I've got a couple of questions. Some were very kind of arcane and very particular. I don't think we have time to get to some of those. But one question, a couple of questions actually has come up about, please put my water bill in gallons as opposed to in units. And this question of water pricing. Judy Faze, you want to say anything about that? We don't have a lot of time, but this is one of those things about how you price water that comes up.
Yes, and I think the governor budgeted $100,000 to do a study on water pricing. There's actually an audit that's coming out tomorrow from the Utah Division of Water Resources by the legislative auditor. They're talking about pricing. I'll bet you a lot of money on that. And also the Utah Foundation did a study where they talked about pricing. It's something that I think is inevitable. And again, everyone we talked to said conservation, re-examining water pricing, re-examining the idea of using property taxes to help pay for water, shift of agricultural water to cities. Those are all things that are on the table and that are open for discussion.
About a minute left. Let me get you both to sort of respond to this idea of Do you get a sense, there's always some in conservative places, expressions of skepticism about climate change, for example. Where are we in Utah, not just in that on that score, but in the idea, is there the political will or the political acknowledgement that these issues need to be dealt with, that there needs to be some kind of paradigm shift? What have you learned about all of that? I'm only a minute left, so that's not really fair to get you to, but what
sure,
do you think?
Sure, I just want to point to a part of Judy's story this morning. We had an air story about the Lake Powell pipeline this morning, and she's got a cut from Governor Gary Herbert talking about water being only the thing that's impending further growth in Utah, and that we live in a desert. And I think that it could be a way for the governor indirectly to be acknowledging that, you know, what's happening in the conditions of our climate will affect our water, our economy, our future as a state, our identity.
And Ron Thompson and Paul Monroe, the two Water Conservancy District people we talked to, both, that's part of their, he said, Ron says, we have to plan for the future, and a changing climate is part of the future. He may not have said climate change, but the same way you're talking about it, but he means it. And it's a factor that I think everyone's taking into account, even if they're not using that word or that term.
Judy Faze, KUER's environmental reporter, Terry Gilday, KUER's news director. Thank you both.
Thanks, Doug,
for being with us.
Thank you.
Congratulations. Good job. It's a lot of work. It's a joint project of KUER News and KUED Channel 7. A free screening of it tomorrow evening at the Utah Museum of Contemporary Arts. You can watch it on KUED Wednesday evening at 7. We should also mention Terry and Judy have produced a series of related stories that you're going to be hearing throughout the week. We have details about all of that on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.